This is Functional Medicine Update for December 2001, Volume 21, Number 12. On Side 1 this month, our topics will include a growing awareness of functional genomics and functional proteomics, smoking and heart disease, type 2 diabetes, chronic fatigue syndrome, and nutrients that modulate gene expression patterns. Side 2 will include our clinician interview with Dr. Thomas Klug, discussing C2 and C16 estrogen, a report on methyl oxalation and hormone detoxification, dietary influences of flax on hormone balance, and a study on dietary supplementation in late-stage tumor patients. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the December 2001 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for our December 2001 issue. Again, we're closing out another year as we move into our 20th year together. Those of you that have been with us all of these many years, thanks a million for sharing a couple of decades as we move into 2002. And those of you that are new listeners and participants in Functional Medicine Update, welcome aboard and look forward to being with you over the course of the next year. As you probably know, we have our 9th International Symposium on Functional Medicine coming up. We've got it on the big board now. It's going to be held at a 5-star resort in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. We are very excited about the program in the late May week of the 25th through the 29th of May, 2002. So please put that date on your calendar. I think this is going to be a great opportunity for us to have our celebration coming together and sharing information. Our focus this next year will be on neurological and specific functional disorders of the nervous system and orthomolecular psychiatry, neurology, ADHD relationships, autism from a functional medicine perspective. So I believe that we've assembled a wonderful group of plenary speakers and an excellent group of workshop leaders, and this should be another one of those great celebratory weeks for those of you who can make it to our 9th International Symposium on Functional Medicine. By the way, you can get more information by calling our toll-free number, 800-843-9660, or you can check into our website, www.fxmed.com, to find out more about our Functional Medicine Symposium coming up in May of 2002. As you know, we've been focusing the whole of this year on the promotion of healthy aging through the modulation of the neuroendocrine immune systems, a topic that really defines the domains of what we might call functional endocrinology, a topic that really has no single textbook that you can rely on to pull all this information together. So we have been collaboratively assembling this information over the course of the last now 12 months, and through our voices of our clinicians and our researchers of the month, each month trying to learn more about functional neuroendocrine immunology. A lot of this is dependent, I think you can hear from the tone of these discussions, on the evolution of our understanding of functional genomics and functional proteomics, terms that were not even in our vocabulary until very recently. I can see with the increasing acceleration of the way that this is being discussed in the literature, both the primary research literature and in the clinical literature, that the constructs of functional genomics and proteomics are here to stay. Let me give a quick kind of thumbnail definition of those two terms. Functional genomics refers to how our genes, our pluripotential messages that are locked into our book of life, our 23 pairs of chromosomes, are expressed as a consequence of the constitutive and inducible factors that are regulated and translated into ultimate messages that control physiology and cellular function. And we now recognize functional genomics is really another way of saying biochemical individuality, because it has to do with how our genes are influenced to be expressed under different conditions: diet, lifestyle, environment, stress, toxins, trauma. All of these various factors, ischemia, modify the way that genes are expressed and therefore modify the phenotype. So this is the genotype slash environment influencing phenotype connection. The other part of this terminology, which is functional proteomics, refers to how, once the gene has been transcribed and translated, how it ultimately ends up into active protein, in other words, into something that influences cellular function. And we should not assume that all of the DNA in our chromosomes or our genes that is being transcribed is ultimately translated into active protein. In fact, evidence now suggests that only about 50% of the genes that are transcribed into messenger RNA ultimately end up in active protein. The translation of the messenger RNA into protein is dependent upon, obviously, ribosomal protein synthesis, which is dependent upon a whole variety of other environmental, nutritional, and lifestyle considerants, and then the epigenetic modification of those proteins once they're synthesized at the ribosome by things like phosphorylation, sulfation, glycation, oxidation, these post-translational effects that then influence the ultimate folding or functional personalities of the protein. And what am I really saying? Let's use an example. How about hemoglobin A1C, or glycosylated hemoglobin? We know that's a post-translational influence on the protein molecule hemoglobin by the non-enzymatic reaction of glucose with the epsilon amino group of lysyl residues on the beta chain of hemoglobin. And therefore, what you get is a glycosylated protein, a modified protein that has sugars attached to it that then changes its personality, changes its function. So that's an epigenetic or off-the-gene modification of protein. And proteomics is really a measurement of both the transcription-translation process and also the epigenetic post-translational effects that then influence protein or enzyme activity. And the combination of functional genomics and functional proteomics is what then regulates a cellular phenotype, tissue, and organ system function. And many variables, mind-body connections, influence the genotype-phenotype relationship. Environmental toxins, chronic infection, inflammatory agents, drugs and medication, alcohol, all of these are now known to influence specific relationships within the genotype-phenotype connection and therefore relate to our better understanding of functional genomics and functional proteomics. Now, I've said on a number of examples in previous issues of Functional Medicine Update that we should not assume that the way we learn genetics is the way that it actually operates in human systems over decades of living. The way most of us learned it was what is called Mendelian genetics, Gregor Mendel, the recessives and dominant traits that we got from our inheritance factors from the sperm meeting the egg, and the almost deterministic view that these are hardwired into our phenotypes, and there's nothing we can do to escape from these recessive or dominant characteristics, that if they're homozygous recessive and they are very serious, that they lead to premature death or at least premature illness. We know of this from the work that has been done on the genetic metabolism diseases or disorders of infancy, like Tay-Sachs, Wilson's, Gauchers, Fabry's, homocysteemia, phenylketonuria. These are classic examples of point gene mutation types of disorders that relate then to potentially lethal characteristics in the infant or at least in the child. The same thing with Werner's disease and progeria, or the same things with Huntington's disease. And there are over 5,000 of these metabolic disorders that have been identified that are related to a single nucleotide polymorphisms or mutations of the gene that are so severe that the life expectancy or at least the viability of the organism in their younger years is jeopardized. The kinds of conditions, however, that people die of in our country today are not predominantly caused by single nucleotide polymorphisms or mutations that create life-threatening events in infancy or in youth. Rather, they're the conditions that relate then to the production of dysfunction over years of living, decades in fact, that produce coronary heart disease, stroke, diabetes, cancer, various inflammatory disorders, the relationships to metastatic processes and type 2 diabetes and so forth. These are not single gene diseases. And in fact, there's a wonderful discussion of this in a recent issue of Science Magazine entitled The Land Between Mendelian and Multifactorial Inheritance. This is Science Volume 293, page 2213 in the year 2001. And in this particular article, they go on to point out that we generally divide genetic disorders into Mendelian and multifactorial characteristics. And in the classical Mendelian inheritance, a change in observable features, i.e. the phenotype, arises as a consequence of mutations in one dominant or both recessive copies of a gene. And that's the way many of us learned genetics, was this very deterministic hardwired model. In contrast, however, the multifactorial diseases, such as diabetes, asthma, heart disease, cancer, arthritis, and so forth, seem to be caused by more than one gene with a contribution from environmental factors, and it's the weaving together of the environment with polygenes or multigenes to give rise to the different expression patterns, i.e., functional genomics and functional proteomics, that results then in these diseases that are unique to the individual that we lump together with broad ICD-9 descriptors called diagnoses. So coronary heart disease or cerebrovascular disease or cancer may be a very broad descriptor for individual functional changes that have occurred by the interaction of genes with the environment to give rise to that individual's own unique type of dysfunction, which then just for the simplicity gets called a specific disease. As Dr. George Lundberg has said in his recent book, which talks about the nature of medicine today, called Severed Trust, he suggests that the importance of diagnosis is declining very significantly over the last decade as the mechanisms of disease that come out of the interaction of genes and environment are starting to be better understood. So the future of medicine is more focused on mechanisms and functionality rather than on diagnosis. That's a very interesting insight into this transition that's occurring within our medical paradigm. It's not to say that diagnosis is unimportant, but it says that it's only a part of the understanding of what led that patient to a specific point in their dysfunction and how one then might remediate it by looking at the unique interaction of that person's genotype with their environment and the expression then through the whole cycle into functional proteomics. So I think that this genotype-phenotype discussion in this article, The Land Between Mendelian and Multifactorial Inheritance Patterns, is profound, in other words, marker along the landscape of this change in thinking that we're seeing within medicine. Some examples of that, just to give you some real-world observations about how this might translate into medicine, let's look at smoking and heart disease. As you know, not every smoker gets heart disease. Therefore, one might say, well, it's just the luck of the draw. It's not the luck of the draw, it's the interaction of specific features within smoke and specific aspects of their genetic susceptibilities and their post-translational influences that smoking can have on proteomics. That's what we learned from a recent paper in The Lancet, volume 358, page 115 in 2001, entitled APOE4 and Coronary Heart Disease in Middle-Aged Men Who Smoke, a prospective study, in which they evaluated then those types of genotypes that are more susceptible to the adverse effects of oxidants that are a result of cigarette smoking. And they found, as we have been talking to now for over 4 years, that the APOE4 genotype, be it either the homozygous or heterozygous forms, increases the relative susceptibility to oxidant initiators or pro-inflammatory agents. And in this study, it seems that cigarette smoke is one of those initiators. And therefore, the APOE4 genotypes have significantly enhanced a risk to heart disease over the APOE2 or APOE3, either homozygous or mixed genotypes. Now, that does not mean that the APOE2s and 3s have no risk. It just means that their risk is lower than the risk of the more oxidant or inflammation-prone APOE4 individual. The editorial that goes along with this article, again, amplifies this genotype-environment-phenotype connection that we are describing over the last 4 or 5 years in Functional Medicine Update. It goes on to say the genotype-specific effects of smoking on the risk of coronary heart disease are starting to be much more well understood, and they have to do with these post-translational as well as transcriptional and translational effects at the functional level. And I'm quoting from the article, we're seeing more and more use of functional as a term that really relates where medicine is going. It's kind of showing the vector or kind of showing the transition of medicine from a deterministic Mendelian view of disease to this wide array of expression patterns that then create a dysfunction in the tissue or organ that ultimately arrives at disease at the functional level. So cigarette smoking, its interrelationship with APOE4, the increased risk to oxidation of LDL, the alteration in endothelial nitric oxide synthase activity in the APOE4 versus the APOE2 or 3 individuals. So the mechanisms are all starting to be recognized, and how that interrelates then with detoxification of various substances within smoke that have to do with the cytochrome P450 family and their unique differences in detoxification effects in the different APOE genotypes. So you'll notice that we're starting to get a much more genetically specified type of risk factor analysis that heads us towards personalized medicine. And by the way, when the APOE4 genotypes were first discussed, the literature was very clear that this was like a hardwired death sentence. I'm exaggerating there to make a point. But there was nothing you could do about it. If you had a family that had given you an APOE4, woe is your luck in life, because there's nothing you could really do to modify that genetic characteristic. So a lot of people might say, well, I don't want to know my APOE genotype, because if I'm a 4, I don't want to know it. I just live my life 3 sheets to the wind and hope for the best. However, now what's becoming much more well recognized is that that is just a susceptibility factor, and it's only when the APOE4 genotype is plunged into, quote, a harmful environment, end quote, that's harmful, unique to those characteristics, that the expression pattern into the phenotype becomes increasing risk to all sorts of diseases, not just heart disease, but cancer and dementia of Alzheimer's as well, that's associated with APOE4 genotypes. And therefore, alcohol, high-fat diets, or cigarette smoking are all environmental stressors that have been shown to increase the risk of these diseases in susceptible genotypes, of which APOE4 is one. Can you see the new medicine emerging from this? I mean, Roger Williams talked about this in the 50s as the genetotrophic theory of disease and biochemical individuality. Linus Pauling talked about it in the late 40s as molecular medicine, and we're now starting to see it be called functional genomics and proteomics, or what I would call the underpinnings of functional medicine. So it's not just a characteristic, but it's a characteristic related to the unique genotype of the individual that may translate into the phenotype of disease. Let me use another example. Again, we'll keep with the heart disease connection here for a second, because that's, I think, an interesting area. And that is, how about risk factors for heart disease that extend beyond that of cholesterol elevation, LDL cholesterol elevation? You know, we have been discussing Paul Ridker's work for the last several years in Functional Medicine Update, in which at Harvard Medical School as a cardiology research professor, he's been talking about extended risk factors for cardiovascular disease, ApoA, fibrinogen, homocysteine, high sensitivity C-reactive protein, as other biomarkers for heart disease that go beyond that of the traditional cholesterol, HDL, LDL, total cholesterol relationships. As you can see from my previous discussion with APOE4 and its relationship to heart disease risk through precipitating factors like cigarette smoking and other oxidant initiators, so is the relationship then tied to pro-inflammatory mediators and heart disease through these same initiators. And in fact, it looks like Rudolf Virchow was pretty prescient back in the 19th centuries as the German physiologist, in which he said back then that heart disease, or what we would call arterial sclerosis or atherosclerosis, is an inflammatory condition, not a cholesterol condition. And in fact, he was very convinced that if you looked at the atheroma or the lesion, that it was an inflammatory type of lesion that later stage became included with cholesterol deposition and with calcification, but the early stage was inflammation. And that's what we see in a recent article in The Lancet that follows on this theme, Soluble Adhesion Molecules and the Prediction of Coronary Heart Disease, a prospective study and meta-analysis of a variety of other previously published data. This appeared in volume 358, page 971 in 2001, that indicates that the measurement of adhesion molecules, intracellular adhesion molecule 1, or ICAM-1, and vascular associated adhesion molecule VCAM-1, or E-selectin, are strong predictors of relative risk to atherosclerosis or heart disease when they are elevated. And in fact, in the editorial that follows this article, which is on page 946 of the same issue of the journal, there is a chart or a table that shows the relative predictive ability or prognostic value of various extended cardiovascular biomarkers in healthy women in this case, showing that C-reactive protein, the high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, has a relative risk prognostic value that is significantly greater, in fact almost twofold greater than that of LDL cholesterol. So if you're looking only at cholesterol and not looking at inflammatory mediators, you may be missing in that individual a risk factor that's twice the relative risk to heart disease than that of cholesterol itself. And these extended risk factors, again, are mediators that are produced in response of that individual's genotype to their environment. So when we start talking about increasing ICAM-1 or VCAM-1 levels or P-selectin or E-selectin or C-reactive protein, We're talking about the production of various inflammatory mediating molecules that are responding to a specific series of stressors in the environment that are unique to that individual's genotype. We're doing functional genomics and proteomics at the applied clinical level by starting to look at these kinds of variables, beyond that of just looking at LDL cholesterol itself. So, again, I think that the translation of what appears to be very esoteric variables, these variables related to functional genomics and proteomics, which may appear to be highfalutin language, it's too fundamental in science to be really related to the practice of medicine, are now being seen as translated into the assessment and to the treatment protocols that will personalize medicine on a functional basis for the individual. Now, where does the modulation of many of these particular functionalities occur? At what level? Where is the interaction between the environment of that organism and ultimately the messages that then alter gene expression? What is emerging there is what you already know, and it's probably the organic underpinning of the mind-body medicine connection, and that is through the hypothalamus pituitary axes, through the interrelationship between neuroendocrine function and ultimately secondary components of the immune and endocrine messaging system that then regulates the function at the genomic level of every cell in the body. Did you hear what I just said? I just stopped for a second because I think that was a profound moment of silence. What we're saying is that in the outside world, there are sights and sounds and smells and touches and tastes and traumas and electromagnetic radiation in the visible and non-visible spectrum, antigens, toxins, you name it, which are being sensed through this very adept system that we have called our sensory and both parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, translation of those through the hypothalamus and pituitary axes, through the pineal gland, through the amygdala, through the deep structures of our central nervous system that is first the flight deck that correlates or orchestrates this is the cortex of our brain, this highly adept higher learning center that separates us from supposedly lower animals, the animals driven by their medulla oblongata. In our case, we have this frontal lobe and the cortexual components of the brain that hold these messages and these abilities to make patterns out of recognized information and translate it into electrical and chemical signals that orchestrate the symphonic outcome of our body's function. And therefore, it's all of these variables translated and sieved through this receiving system, our sights and sounds and perceptions, that ultimately then creates our individual response to our environment that influences then the expression of our genes in unique ways by up and down regulating their expression to create then secondary molecules that come off of their transcription translation process through epigenetic post-translational modification and then create a different phenotype. And that phenotype may be the phenotype of homeostasis of disease. We often think of homeostasis as being a word that defines health, the maintenance of health. But it's possible to be in a steady state of dis-ease as well, in which you have shifted your gene expression patterns into the patterns of alarm, which stays with a person, not for an hour or a day or a week or a month, but maybe for years. And these shifted patterns become new homeostatic resting points of dis-ease. I will call them functional disabilities, because now it starts collecting damage over time and ultimately leads to a chronic-related illness that was modulated through the activation or effective changes in the functional state of the hypothalamus pituitary axis and their response in terms of messenger molecules. Now, let me take an example of that just to show you what I'm speaking to. Let's talk about type 2 diabetes, the most common form of diabetes now in our culture. Some 30-plus years ago when I was in my postgraduate training, I was told that diabetes was a disorder associated with the insufficiency of the peptide or protein hormone insulin, and that the beta cells of the pancreas were unable to secrete enough insulin to meet the needs of that individual, and therefore blood sugar was elevated and then driving into the insulin-insensitive tissues too much sugar. This would be the nerves and the kidneys and the eyes, producing then activation of secondary metabolic pathways called the sorbitol pathway or the aldose reductase pathway that created cataracts in the lenses of the eyes or created nephropathy or created peripheral neuropathy through these glucose-mediated dysfunctions on the secondary tissues that were insulin-independent tissues. That was the model that I learned in school as to what its etiology was all about. And it was generally thought that it was tied very closely to genes, that people had the genetics because it came in families. What I've just described, obviously, are the type 1 forms of diabetes, which constitute about 5% traditionally of the overall cases of diabetes. And in fact, that percentage of a population with type 1 diabetes has remained rather constant throughout time, and it's even constant in other populations. What has changed, however, is the prevalence of type 2 diabetes, the so-called maturity onset, although we have to change that term now because the most rising number of people that are getting type 2 diabetes are not adults, they are adolescents. So let's just call it type 2, which is insulin-resistant diabetes, which is often associated not with low levels of insulin, but high levels of insulin, hyperinsulinemia. And we've spoken so much to this in Functional Medicine Update through the last several years with Syndrome X and Dr. Gerald Reaven and the compensated and non-compensated forms of insulin resistance. What we're starting to recognize is that the most prevalent form of this rising pandemic called diabetes is that of type 2 insulin resistance, sometimes hyperinsulinemic diabetes with glucose abnormalities. And then we start asking, well, why are we seeing increasing prevalence of this in an age-adjusted study? Is it because we have bad genes that suddenly are showing up, or is it because we're modifying the environment in such a way as to create different gene expression patterns and different proteomic outcomes? And if so, one might expect then the variables that associate themselves with the environment genotype connection, i.e. diet and lifestyle, may be the more important variables that regulate or at least influence the prevalence of this condition, type 2 diabetes. Well, that's been a long-standing question in the literature for which no one has developed a definitive answer. But another step along the road towards developing a definitive answer was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, Volume 345, page 790 in 2001, work from Walter Willett and Meyer Stamfer's group at Harvard entitled Diet, Lifestyle, and the Risk of Type 2 Diabetes Mellitus in Women. And this was a result of the 84,941 female nurses that were studied from 1980 to 1996. And these women were free from diagnosed cardiovascular disease, diabetes, or cancer at the baseline, and then followed prospectively over many years. And what was found was that the majority of the cases of type 2 diabetes seen in this group of nurses could, in fact, be related to alterations in their diet and lifestyle that resulted in adverse expression of multigenes that then created an environmental factor at the phenotype that is called diabetes, for lack of an easier definition, meaning insulin dysfunction and dysglycemia. And so in this paper, they conclude that the hypothesis that the majority of cases of type 2 diabetes in the United States culture could be prevented by the adoption of a healthier lifestyle are strongly supported. And that's, I think, a very profound clinical takeaway from this long-winded discussion that I've been sharing with you concerning functional genomics and proteomics. What we're really talking about is the mismatch of a sandpile of genotypes, which is what the U.S. genotypes are, is a sandpile from different ethnic diversities that the culture has experienced over the last many years, and that then, when matched with our common environment, diet, lifestyle, exercise patterns, results in the expression of a phenotype. As we move through functional genomics and functional proteomics, the phenotype becomes that, for convenience sake, is called diabetic. Well, that is a very important part of our evolving model of medicine, because now it's not a disease in search of a drug. It's a functional condition in search of the appropriate environment to create a different gene expression profile and proteomic outcome that relates not to disinsulinism, but to normal insulin modulation of cellular function. Because remember, insulin doesn't just influence blood sugar alone. It also influences gene expression, protein tyrosine kinases, and other types of transcription factors are modulated at the genome level as a consequence of insulin. So this symphonic orchestration of these mediators that are influenced by environmental factors then creates a shift in metabolism that we then later define as disease. I hope you can appreciate the remarkable power of this new emerging model, what Thomas Kuhn called a scientific paradigm shift in the structure of scientific revolutions. We are really witnessing, we're living through one of the most profound eras of transition in thinking in medicine that any human species has ever lived through. The medicine that we will practice tomorrow as a consequence of the application of this model will be vastly different than the medicine built on the deterministic Mendelian model of single gene mutation producing disease, which then requires single drugs to treat single outcomes. That's a different model. When I say a single drug, I really mean a single molecule to create a single outcome to treat a single disease. Now, with that in mind, let me talk about a disorder which I think is a very good example of the types of disorders that we're seeing in this multi-gene interrelationship with a multifactorial environment to produce a phenotypic change in outcome. And that's the condition chronic fatigue syndrome. As you know, since Paul Cheney and his colleagues first identified in Incline Village in Nevada the post-viral fatigue syndrome that appeared after a bad flu season, this is back in the 1970s, we've seen a virtual landslide of articles that have been published talking about different etiological contributors to this post-viral fatigue syndrome, myalgic encephalitis, or chronic fatigue syndrome with or without fibromyalgia syndrome. What has emerged through all of this, I believe, that there's some commonalities of the multitude of different papers that have been published, is that there seems to be a very interesting interrelationship of chronic fatigue syndrome to the activation of the hypothalamus pituitary axis. So there's a neuroendocrine immune component of it. The origin of this upregulation and initiation can be a variety of different contributors, and in fact we might even have a total load. It's not just a viral infection by itself, but it may be a viral infection on top of a stress that's been chronic, on top of a trauma, on top of a toxic exposure, on top of a poor quality diet. So we start loading the messenger system of the body with more and more perturbing factors until eventually it shifts over to a different steady state, a different dog chasing its tail, a different harmonic vibration of gene expression patterns that we call the HPA disactivated system, the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal thyroid disactivated system. Now, many factors obviously can influence that dysregulation and that altered gene expression pattern, and therefore many factors might be associated with its remediation, breaking the link of this cycle. Many drugs have been tried to try to intervene at the different symptom levels that appear in this patient. And one might say, well, what is the perfect drug? And if you think of this as a polygene phenomena, then there's not just one molecule, not just one drug that's going to suddenly solve this problem. It's got a multiple components, so it may require a multiple factorial therapeutic intervention. It may have to be personalized to the individual. And that appears to be what we have learned from a recent paper that appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Maybe you saw this. This was entitled Interventions for the Treatment and Management of Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, a Systematic Review. This is work from the National Health Science Center at the University of York in England, also at San Antonio's Evidence-Based Practice Center, Department of Medicine at UTEP San Antonio. And this appeared in volume 286, page 1360, 2001 in JAMA, an editorial that followed in page 1378. The bottom line is that when examining a variety of different therapies, and I won't go through what those therapies were that they studied, but suffice it to say that they looked at 44 trials, including a group of 2,001 participants that had been published with 38 different outcomes and 130 different scales of types of measurements. So there's a wide variety of different types of studies and different biomarkers and different outcome variables. And they then broke down all these therapies into four different categories: pharmacological, nutritional supplements, complementary/alternative, and other interventions. And what they conclude from this analysis of data was that the interventions demonstrated mixed results in terms of effectiveness. All conclusions about effectiveness should be considered together with the methodological inadequacies of these studies, because there was no set standard of evaluation. Interventions which have shown the most promising results include cognitive behavioral therapy and graded exercise therapy. Now, what role do those have on link-breaking alterations in expression of the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal thyroid axis? Well, that's a very good question. In other words, are these neuroendocrine immune therapies that help to establish a different set point of gene expression and proteomics in individuals who have activated and dysregulated HPA-HPT axes? Well, that's a pretty interesting question, isn't it? Because we know we can use the mind to alter body function. In fact, by thinking through imagery and meditation and relaxation therapy and music and exercise, we can repoise in our hypothalamus and pituitary the messenger molecules that are sent to the rest of the body, which then create ultimately effects on gene expression and changing the phenotypic outcome of cell function. So would we expect then the mind to have an influence over the body in a condition that was caused by dysregulation of the HPA axis? And I think my answer would be yes, and that seems to be what this data suggests. Now, does this say that metabolic or other types of interventions are useless? Of course it doesn't. What it indicates is that the answers to these complex syndromes may come not from single molecules for single conditions, but rather from more integrated therapies that utilize the marriage or the interrelationship of that individual's genetic pluripotentiality with the dysregulations of their environment to produce then a better outcome by modulating their environment. And that's what the editorial that follows this article on page 1378 says, chronic fatigue trial syndromes and how this really relates to differing influences of the mind on the body and how lifestyle variables can play a significant role. Does this mean these are psychosomatic diseases? Well, if you believe the word psychosoma means mind-body, I guess every disease is really a mind-body disease, so that would almost be a given, yes. But in terms of the negative connotation of psychosomatic, as if it was, quote, all in the mind, end quote, I don't think we can jump to that conclusion at all, because all in the mind, the body is the mind is the body. These hormonal messengers, these messenger molecules we're describing, have receptor sites on all cells of the body, as Candace Pert has told us in The Molecules of Emotion and her work. And therefore, we know that there's this interrelationship between molecular events that occur and thought, beliefs, and behaviors and attitudes. However, it also suggests that there can be real things in the environment, call it molecular personifications or materialisms, that can be toxin molecules. That's other factors that can produce toxic events in the body. So you can have toxic thoughts, you can have toxic chemicals, you can have endotoxins, exotoxins, inflammatory mediators. All of these variables that we've been describing create a different outcome. They can lock a person into a chronic fatigue fibromyalgia condition for years, making a complex therapy more likely to throw the net over these variables in a positive way. Well, what about diet that then manipulates these variables? Let's talk a little bit about specific dietary considerations that help to lower the body load of some of these toxins. These are foods that have certain nutrients in them that modulate gene expression of the detoxification enzyme systems. We know of one family of foods that has been extensively studied that has these properties, and that's the cruciferous vegetables, the broccoli and the Brussels sprouts, the cauliflower and the cabbage family. We've talked a lot about the role that these glucosinolates have and how they're broken down by the enzyme myrosinase found in the plant cell, which then can convert the glucosinolates into secondary chemicals that have names like indole-3-carbinol and phenylisothiocyanate and 2-hydroxy-3-butene and sulforaphane. And these secondary chemicals then influence gene expression in very specific ways to upregulate the expression and activity of specific types of detoxification enzymes, either phase 1 or phase 2 enzymes. A paper that describes this in a human study recently was published in the journal Carcinogenesis, volume 22, page 1413 in 2001, that showed that individuals who consume increased crucifers in their diet and eat charbroiled meats will have increased detoxification of the heterocyclic aromatic amines that are associated with charbroiling meat, these potential carcinogens, and therefore they can activate detoxification of these carcinogens by consuming broccoli with their steak, which, you know, is a way that we have eaten traditionally, is by dietary carcinogens and anti-carcinogens, to steal a phrase from Dr. Bruce Ames from the cover of Science magazine now near 10 years ago, where he talked about the balance between dietary carcinogens and anti-carcinogens. What about the detoxification of endogenous estrogens? On side two of this month's Functional Medicine Update, we're going to have an interview with our researcher of the month, Dr. Thomas Klug, who will talk about estrogen metabolism from the 2 and the 16 hydroxyestrogen metabolic perspective, showing that the 2 hydroxyestrogens tend to be anti-estrogenic and the estrogen breaks on mitotic activity and cell replication and cell cycling, whereas the 16 hydroxyestrogen is that which is a highly estrogenic cell mitotic stimulator. And therefore, one might ask, can you, in women that have their estrogens running away with them, with increasing 16 and lowered 2, can you then improve their 2 hydroxylation patterns? And the answer is yes. There are dietary variables, soy isoflavones, lignans from various plant foods, and the substances that are found within cruciferous vegetables, specifically indole-3-carbinol, and one of its metabolites, dienoylmethane, influence then the 2 and the 16 hydroxylation patterns. In a recent paper again published in the journal Carcinogenesis, volume 22, page 1573, in 2001, it was shown that these catechol estrogen metabolites, the 2 hydroxyestrogens, and their glutathione and glucuronic acid and sulfate conjugates were related then to the reduced risk of mammary tumors. And if you prevented the animal from actually being able to manufacture these 2 hydroxyestrogens, you actually increase the risk to mammary tumor initiation. So again, it indicates that the way that we metabolize the estrogens then may play a very significant role in modifying gene expression patterns, because these hormonal metabolites are gene expression modulators. The same thing was found true in a teratogenicity and mutagenicity study on the catechol estrogens, and looking at the difference between the 16 versus the 2 hydroxy and the 4 hydroxy estrogens. This is again published in the same journal, Carcinogenesis, volume 22, page 1505 in this case, in the 2001 year, in which it showed that 17-beta-estradiol and estrone are minor stimulators of DNA damage, whereas if you then produce more of the 4-hydroxyestrogen or the 2-hydroxyestrogen, you then modify the actual production of these mutagenic agents. The 4-hydroxyestrone appeared to be the most powerful DNA-transforming substance, and therefore, if there is an adverse metabolism of estrogen into the 16-hydroxy and the 4-hydroxy families, there is an increased risk then to mitogenic and cell-transforming and carcinogenic activity. These are very important parts of the story, because these metabolic shifts are related to gene expression shifts, the modification of the detoxification enzyme expressions off the genes, which then creates differing families of estrogen metabolites, depending on whether the cytochrome P450-1A2 is upregulated or the cytochrome P450-1B1, which more converts estrogen into the 16 and the 4-hydroxylated families. So again, how do you modify this? You can't change your genes, but you can change the way you expose your genes to certain kinds of communicating agents. Indole-3-carbinol, for instance, from crucifers, will selectively upregulate the expression of the 2-hydroxylating enzymes of the cytochrome P450 family, so it lowers then 16-hydroxylation at the expense of increasing 2-hydroxylation. It lowers the 4-hydroxylation at the expense of increasing the 2-hydroxylation. So crucifers, we would say, have a positive benefit on normalizing estrogen metabolism. What about in males? Androgen receptors and androgen metabolism of eteocolanolone, of testosterone. This has to do with human prostate cancer risk. And as we'll hear on side two of this month's tape, estrogen metabolism plays a role in prostate cancer, as it does with the gentleman's sister's risk to breast and endometrial cancer. Recently, it's been found that the interesting herbal product, Silymarin, which comes from milk thistle concentrate, inhibits the function of the androgen receptor by reducing nuclear localization of this receptor and modifying detoxification in such a way as to normalize androgen receptor activity. So we might consider, at least from this study, Carcinogenesis, volume 22, page 1399 in 2001, suggesting that Silymarin has a positive impact upon detoxification of androgens and the relationship it has then to androgen receptor activity in the prostate gland. Again, I want to emphasize this is a cell line, a prostate human prostate cell line, so this is an in vitro study, but it certainly starts to get us thinking that there are agents which we know influence hepatic detoxification, i.e. Silymarin, which can influence then how various messenger molecules translate into genetic expression effects. Many of these particular molecules are part of the flavonoid family, and there's a wonderful review of flavonoids, how they participate in modification of genetic expression. And as you know, there's something on the order of 4,000 variety of flavonoids in various foods that have been identified, and these are responsible for the attractive colors of flowers, fruit, and leaves, and therefore eating color in our diet is very important for getting adequate levels of flavonoid. Whiteness in our diet is not so good, so we want to get more flavonoids, catechins, and anthocyanins into our diet. And this is all beautifully described in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Volume 74, page 418, in which it talks about how the colored red, yellow, orange, blue, violet plant foods, both fruit and vegetables, influence in a positive way things like immunochemical function, reducing cellular proliferation and cell cycling, and have antioxidant effects and lower cholesterol and chelate iron. So we are witnessing the emergence of a new medicine in which the modulators of function will be, to a great extent, those things we do to ourselves every day, how we think, how we act, where we live, what we're exposed to, what we eat, whether we exercise. And those then translate into the polygenomic outcome called our phenotype. That is exactly what Dr. Klug will be talking about as our representative on Side 2 of this month's Functional Medicine Update. Well, once again, we're at that part of Functional Medicine Update where it's the news to use from the expert section, which is our clinician or researcher of the month. And this month, in our format of kind of alternating clinicians and researchers, we have this month Dr. Thomas Klug. Dr. Klug is a expert in the area of estrogen metabolism. He actually has done some collaborative work in his past experience with Dr. Bradlow, who we heard speak at our 8th International Symposium on Functional Medicine as it related to some of the aspects of estrogen metabolism. Dr. Klug, if you go back in his background as a researcher and a contributor, has worked on hypothalamus, pituitary, adrenal-related functional statuses in animal studies. He's published extensively in the area of method development for analyzing the 2 and 16 hydroxy estrogen metabolites, and has done considerable amount of work looking at the physiological influence and effects of these types of compounds as messenger molecules. So there would be no person better that I believe we could have in this issue of Functional Medicine Update to help us understand what really is happening at this very important juncture in our evolution of understanding of the estrogen family, and particularly these downstream metabolites and their role in female and maybe even male health. So Dr. Klug, we really welcome you to Functional Medicine Update, and clearly with your role now as a principal in ImmunoCare Corporation in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, you've focused a lot of your attention in developing methods for analysis of these estrogen metabolites. But before we get into talking about the methods, maybe you can tell our listeners how you got into this area. I think it's a very fascinating area, obviously, that's rapidly evolving.
Well, my background was in developing immunodiagnostics for cancer research. And we wanted, as a company, to really do innovative things in the area of women's health. We noted that there is virtually no diagnostic tests that could really be used to determine a woman's risk for breast cancer and other estrogen-related diseases. And this led us to exhaust our research literature to try to find out, to get a handle on what kind of tests could be evolved to determine a woman's risk for estrogen-related cancers, and then also how to manage that risk. And this led us to the area of estrogen metabolism. We noted that several lifestyle factors, including a woman's diet or how she exercised, influenced whether or not she developed estrogen-related cancers. And we discovered through looking at the literature that there was a group at the Rockefeller University working on this very question of how estrogen metabolism was modulated by a woman's lifestyle and other factors. And working collaboratively with that group, we developed diagnostic tests for key metabolites of estrogen that are indeed related to a woman's risk factors. And these estrogens and their levels are modulated by such factors as a woman's diet, how she exercises, whether or not she smokes, etc. And we think that this has really developed into a new paradigm to manage breast cancer. Not only the risk for it, but once a woman has breast cancer, to determine what changes she needs to make in her lifestyle, in her diet, to affect the likely outcome and course of the disease.
You know, it's very fascinating, I'm sure even more so for you, having been a primary investigator in this area, how we've moved over the years from the assumption that we knew enough about estrogen to treat women successfully going through perimenopause and menopause with various types of hormone replacement therapy, only to find later as research progressed that we discovered there were all sorts of other interesting and important metabolites like the 16-hydroxyestrone and estradiol that may have equal or greater influence on how estrogen influences female physiology than the estrone and estradiol molecules themselves. So how do you feel that this discovery in the understanding of these metabolites has been accepted by medicine? Are we starting to see doctors in the obstetrics and gynecology area understanding this, the endocrinology area?
Well, as in any new finding, there's always people who are adapt early to new information. In general, this has been the physicians in the alternative medicine field because they are the physicians who are more willing to try new things. The mainstream physician generally is a follower of what he reads, and he's unlikely to use new things. We find that the people in the alternative medicine field, just to use that phrase, are more advocates of new things. And so we see that there is a general increase in the mainstream. We are getting physicians in the mainstream beginning to use this, but largely, really, the growing area of use is in the alternative medicine practice. People in this field recognize the importance of diet. It was really only when these tests became available that people could really use them. It's been known for years that these metabolites exist, and even there's been some recognition that these are important in the disease process. It's only when the tests became broadly available in easy formats, which is what our corporation did, then this become tools in the management of cancer. So I think, yes, it is becoming available, but it's taking time. That's why I really appreciate speaking a forum like this, because hopefully this kind of forum will accelerate that process.
So let's go back for the listener that may be less familiar with this history, and if you could just maybe give us a brief snapshot of what the history is. How long ago were these 2 and 16-hydroxyestrogen metabolites discovered and recognized to be components of the physiological function of estrogens?
I would say the key work was probably done at the Rockefeller by Drs. Bradlow and Fishman, actually the early 60s, where they're generally looking at the question of what happened to estrogen when it was in a woman's body. So that has been around for, I'd say, roughly 40 to 50 years. The government has spent a lot of money in this area because they knew it was so exciting. But it's interesting that it's like anything, that there's a crest of the wave and there has to be a conjunction of interests. It's just recently that there have become known ways to modulate metabolism, such as the use of endocarbinol, soy in the diet, etc. And so this conjunction of new natural treatments for breast cancer combined with a new test has really exploded the interest in these tests. But I might say that the actual involvement in recognition of the importance of estrogen in breast cancer goes back over 100 years. It was known by Beetson in 1898, where he took the ovaries out of women and discovered that their breast cancer went into remission. However, since that time, there's very little progress in really taking this information about how estrogens are involved in cancer and bringing this into a useful paradigm.
You know, it's very interesting. The number of years you talked about, the 40 to 50 year period, seems to be kind of a standard latent period between the discovery of some major new potential advance in medicine and its final incorporation within practice. I've done studies on this and actually published a paper on this a number of years ago evaluating 10 medical technologies showing that the length of time from their first discovery until final acceptance was about 50 years. So maybe that's a general rule in medicine. You'd think you'd want to have a compression of that with the rapid rate of information transfer we have in this day and age, but it appears like it's still a constant for some reason. I was just in Finland at the University of Helsinki in Finland visiting with Dr. Hermann Adlercreutz, who I know has also been one of the contributors in this area and actually has co-published with Dr. Bradlow in a couple of papers on indole-3-carbinol. This soy and indole-3-carbinol connection to metabolism of estrogen, is that something that you see as a rapidly advancing understanding, or is that still kind of an outlier? Are we still with a 40-50 year rule on that as well?
No, that is now, I would say, that is becoming almost not, I wouldn't say, a standard of care, but it is becoming a routine method of treatment, even to the extent that people, I think, the women in particular, because women are generally more interested in their health than men, are beginning to incorporate vegetables in their diet that contain endocarbinol and sar in their diet, knowing that this indeed will lower the risk for estrogen-dependent diseases. One point I want to make is that breast cancer is not the only estrogen-dependent disease. We've shown using the tests for 2 and 16 that indeed estrogen metabolism is involved in head and neck cancer, the cervical cancer, and probably colon cancer. So the importance of metabolism is what I want to emphasize, just beyond estrogen metabolism, but metabolism is an important factor to consider in all disease processes. We've studied particularly how this involves estrogen. So I would say that, no, there's actually work being sponsored by the federal government, clinical studies looking at endocarbinol. So even the august agencies of our federal government understand the importance of these compounds in reducing disease risk.
Well, that raises another question that I know has been sitting in the literature, which relates to estrogen-related cancers in males. Often we don't think about males and estrogen, but there is some pretty strong evidence indicating that prostate cancer risk may be related to imperfections or alterations in this estrogen metabolism as well. Do you have any thought about the evolving concept in that area?
Well, historically speaking, the association between altered metabolism and breast cancer, the initial studies were done in 1968 and 1970 in males. It was first noted in males. And indeed, when males do have breast cancer, the metabolism is drastically altered, even more so than in women with breast cancer. And I might just say that this is unpublished information. There has been a recent study which has confirmed the link between prostate cancer and estrogen metabolism. That's one problem we have in communicating the importance of this, is there is a lag in getting the results of clinical studies and getting them published. The lag can be often as long as 2 years. And of course, one cannot go out and talk about these results without putting at risk the publication of the data. But I feel this is so important, and I will not mention specifically the study, but there has been a study showing that indeed men with prostate cancer have altered metabolism exactly in the direction as women with breast cancer. So that is a study which will probably be published in the coming year. Yes, estrogen metabolism is also important in men, equally as important, if not more so, because also there's some preliminary evidence connecting this with heart disease as well.
Well, this is fascinating. Obviously, it opens up a whole nature of how functional components of our physiology tie themselves together across genders, across ages, and even across diagnostic codes. And that's one of the things that we obviously stand for in functional medicine, is we're less tied into diagnosis and more tied into understanding mechanisms. And it appears as if this mechanism of estrogen metabolism has a very wide range of potential applications in clinical medicine. So with that in mind, let me ask you about the 2-hydroxy and 16-hydroxyestrogen test. What have been the difficulties in the past, and what advances have your group made in ImmunoCare in making the diagnosis or assessment more specific?
Well, you mentioned Dr. Hermann Adlercreutz, who's really the pioneer in this field. In 1980 and 81, he published the seminal articles of how to detect these metabolites using what's called gas chromatography, mass spectroscopy. However, this was a very time-consuming and expensive test. It can only be done probably in 2 or 3 laboratories in the entire world. What we did is we took, I would say, modern immunodiagnostic techniques, that is, used monoclonal antibodies, to make very specific immunodiagnostic reagents to each of these metabolites. And we then took these antibodies and converted them into diagnostic tests that could be done very quickly and relatively inexpensively. So the test, for example, of metabolites in urine can be done in 3 hours, and the test for metabolites in serum can be done overnight. And the cost of these, instead of being in the hundreds of dollars range, is now in the tens of dollar ranges. This essentially is what we did. We converted this into simple, easy-to-use immunodiagnostic tests, which can be done in any diagnostic laboratory.
And the samples that are used to perform these tests, are these simple and kind of routinely gotten samples from urine and plasma?
Yeah, there's nothing easier to get than urine, which is why we like the test for urine. However, as with any type of diagnostic fluid, there's always optimum conditions of collection and preservation. of the urine and or serum. But these are easily gotten. The metabolites in these media are very stable. Women routinely can collect a urine at home and bring it that morning to the physician for shipment to the laboratory, or the physician can gather the serum very easily.
And how about things such as menstrual cycle or menopausal status, which we might think would alter hormones and therefore could influence the 2:16 ratio? Are those fairly independent or not influential on the ratios?
Well, there is an effect of menstrual cycle in the serum ratio in women. The effect, however, is small relative to the difference one sees between women with breast cancer as opposed to women without it, or women with benign breast disease. However, what is usually done is there is a portion of the menstrual cycle, which is generally a recommended time in which the sample should be collected. For both urine and serum, we recommend in premenopausal women at ovulation or within a week thereafter, what's called the luteal phase, at ovulation or the luteal phase. And in postmenopausal women, we simply recommend that the urine be collected as what's called a first morning urine. This is because the concentrations of the metabolites are highest in the urine in that first urinary void. Postmenopausal women have lower levels, so they're essentially less easy to measure. However, if the urine is collected in the morning, the levels are higher and they can be measured very accurately.
And what about the dietary variables? Someone might ask the question, well, gee whiz, if I had soy beverage the day before I had the test, but I normally don't consume soy, would that create a significant alteration in my test results?
It depends on the amount of it that you had and also the timing. Within 24 hours, one would expect to see no change. And one would not expect to see a change in the metabolite ratio if one simply had a soy drink. The amounts of soy required to change metabolism are in the area of 100 to 200 milligrams a day for several days. A single change in diet, whether it's cabbage, broccoli, would not affect the metabolism. However, if one had large portions of these over a several-day period, it might have an effect.
Now, when you say 100 to 200 milligrams of soy, are you referring to total isoflavones?
Total isoflavones, yes. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's good.
But this amounts to probably 100 to 200 grams of soy protein, which is a lot of soy.
Yes.
So one ordinarily takes the soy isoflavones if one wants to change one's ratio. Now, the important thing to realize here, I believe, is that a woman needs to determine what her current metabolite ratio is. And after that point, she needs to determine whether or not she needs to change her diet to either increase the ratio or, in some women, actually decrease the ratio. Having too high a level of what we call the good estrogens or the 2-hydroxyestrogens is not good either. Women with very high ratios are more in an anti-estrogen situation, and as a consequence, studies reveal she may experience bone loss. So in her case, she needs to look at factors in her lifestyle, in her diet, to reduce the amount of 2-hydroxylation going on.
That's very interesting. So we use this, again, as kind of a parabolic curve of optimal range of the 2:16 ratio. Too low a 2:16 is not good. Too high a ratio is not good. And you want to be in that mid-range. And so what is that mid-range for optimal estrogen metabolism from your work?
Now, this, of course, depends on a woman's individual physiology, her makeup. But one would try to strive for a ratio of around 2 in the urine test, and about 0.5 to 0.6 in the serum test. The reason the ratios are different is because one of the metabolites, that is the 16-hydroxyestrone, binds very tightly to components in the serum, and so it clears from the serum less rapidly. And so this is why it's relatively to the other metabolites a higher concentration, which leads to simply a lower ratio. However, the ratios do correlate between the urine and the serum if the urine is collected appropriately.
So we would say that ratios of the 2:16 hydroxylated estrogens below 2, as we went down to say 1.6, would be indicative of increasing risk or relative concerns about the highly estrogenic 16s in relationship to the lower estrogenic 2s. Is that what we would conclude?
Yes, yes. Now, physiologically what's happening is the 2-hydroxyestrogens, what we call the good estrogens, the catecholestrogens, are easily changed, either increased or decreased, by simple changes in our diet and our lifestyle. The 16-hydroxyestrogens are constitutive. It's more difficult to change these. There are some dietary ways to change the 16, maybe fish oils, etc., but generally speaking, these are hard to change. So what one really wants to look at is the level of the catecholestrogen relative to the 16. There is a broad range of ratios which are probably appropriate. A woman shouldn't worry if she's like a 2.5 or a 1.8 or something. When we look at studies, we speak of them broadly because these are large studies with large numbers of women. This is why it's important. When you look at an individual woman with their overall health picture, not so much just say, well, you have a ratio 1.6. It's important to look at, for example, whether or not that low ratio could be due to the fact that the woman has a high percent body fat. So the ratio is not only a benchmark, but it gives you a tool to make changes in an individual woman's lifestyle. For example, we might find that a woman with 1.6, if she were to lose 10 pounds, her ratio may go to 2. So the ratio not only tells you per se about your estrogens, but tells you in conjunction with the overall medical picture of the woman, her physiology, her medical history. You might, for example, find that the woman's taking antidepressants and she has a low ratio. Immediately that sends up a red flag. Is it the antidepressant that's changed in ratio? Then let's take the woman off the antidepressant. We know that, for example, some antidepressants would lower the ratio. Other antidepressants, for example, things like Prozac, seem to raise the ratio. So one needs to look within an entire context of the medications a woman's taking, her percent body fat, and her diet, how we should change that ratio if we need to change it, and what factors may be changing that ratio. This is indeed the power of this paradigm, is it's all-encompassing, and it gives a woman a benchmark to make positive changes in her life that she can then come back to the doctor and say, I've done this, how has that affected my ratio? Am I in a better shape now? The importance of this is brought to home in another study, which is unpublished, which showed that women with breast cancer who had a ratio above 2 had a mean survival of greater than 10 years. Women with breast cancer with a lower ratio, below 2, had a mean survival of much less than 5 years. Even in women with disease, need to look at that ratio. It's not only a marker for risk, but it's a marker for health in general. Exactly why this, we don't know. I think perhaps that this marker is a surrogate marker for a lot of other things going on, metabolic things. It may be a surrogate marker for antioxidant balance. I'm not sure. But as we go forward, we're finding that absolutely every risk marker for disease is affected positively within the 2 to 16 ratio. You can name any risk factor for breast cancer, it changes that ratio in the appropriate direction. Smoking, alcohol consumption, all affect the ratio and are correlated with disease risk appropriately.
Does this ratio that you described in urine or serum of the 2 to the 16 hydroxyestrogens also relate to males? Is that a similar ratio you would see in males as well, the 2 to 1 ratio in urine and the 0.5 to 1 ratio in serum?
Well, the most potent inducer of the ratio is estrogen itself, as you might expect. When a woman is given estrogen replacement therapy, for example, the amount of her natural antiestrogen, that is the 2 estrogens, increases dramatically. So men who have less estrogen tend to have somewhat lower ratios in blood and serum. This probably reflects that they need less normal antiestrogen. What's happening, Jeff, is that the body has a natural mechanism to control the activity of its own estrogen. As the amount of estrogen in the body increases, more is converted to the antiestrogen, the anti-hormone, as the percent in the estrogen in the body decreases. To keep the amount of bioavailable estrogen constant, the body decreases the 2-hydroxyestrogen. We also see in men have higher levels of androgen. We believe that androgen, per se, lowers the amount of 2-hydroxylation and the catecholestrogen.
Let's talk a little bit about the catecholestrogens that you mentioned. We've been focusing on the 2-hydroxyestrogen catecholestrogen family, but there's increasing discussion about the 4-hydroxylated estrogens and their production of catechols that go on to become the quinones. Do you have any feeling about how that literature is emerging and whether the 4-hydroxys are going to prove to be hazardous relative to their apurinic potential in causing DNA damage?
We are in the midst of developing tests for all the metabolites, including 4-hydroxyestrone. However, we have looked at all the literature correlating enzymes that increase 4-hydroxylation, and indeed this probably is an important factor, but does not seem to be as strongly linked to risk for estrogen potent diseases as the 2 and the 16. I should say, however, the enzymes that produce the 4-hydroxyestrone are very similar to that which produced the 16. It could indeed be, when you measure the 16 indirectly, you're measuring the amount of the 4-hydroxy. They tend to go together. The enzymes that produce these, which are called cytochromes, are very similar. There is specific cytochromes that produce the 4-hydroxy, but these are not found at high levels. I guess the real answer to your question is, we don't know. However, the epidemiological evidence and the biochemical evidence at this time do not point to a strong link between 4-hydroxylation and risk for cancer and other estrogen-dependent diseases.
Let's look, if we can, also at the estriol part of the story, because I know many doctors within the field of functional endocrinology utilize triest or estriol as part of the replacement therapy, and that relates to the 16-hydroxylation pattern. Could you tell us a little bit about that connection?
It's believed that the 16-hydroxyestrone is an extremely potent estrogen. The reason this is because it binds to the estrogen receptor that turns the estrogen receptor inside the cell on and it leaves it on. So it is known that 16-hydroxyestrone, which is a normal metabolite of all estrogens in the body, that is estradiol and estrone, is a very potent estrogen. However, the metabolite that occurs after the production of 16-hydroxyestrone is estriol. Now, they can be interconverted, but generally the pattern is the 16 goes to estriol. So it is thought, well, if I give estriol, then I should not be metabolized into the bad estrogen or the 16-hydroxyestrogen. And indeed, chemically, this does make sense. Biochemically, it makes sense. And there is some evidence in countries where they use estriol as the estrogen replacement therapy, there is a lower risk of breast cancer. However, it's uncertain whether or not this is because they're using estriol or because these countries indeed may have a lower risk of breast cancer, or the women taking it are different in different parts of their life cycle. So I would say it certainly is probably somewhat safer to use estriol as estrogen replacement therapy. However, there is probably an increased risk for breast cancer in women who are taking estriol as there is in women who are taking estrone sulfate or estradiol. If I can just make a slight diversion into the estrogen metabolism story, in terms of estrogen replacement therapy, what we think is important is that we now believe that using our test, you can identify women who should not take estrogen replacement therapy. We think that women who are on estrogen replacement therapy who go on to develop breast cancer do so because they have an inappropriate metabolism of the exogenous estrogen. And indeed, we have done some studies to indicate that only 10% of women who are taking estrogen replacement therapy are at increased risk for breast cancer, very substantially increased risk. The majority of the women, 90% of the women who are on estrogen replacement therapy, are actually reducing their risk for breast cancer by taking estrogen. So what we have here is, if you look at all women taking estrogen replacement therapy, there's roughly a 30% increased risk of developing breast cancer sometime in their life. However, if one removes those women with the excess risk of maybe tenfold increased risk, the risk in the woman taking estrogen replacement therapy, the 90%, the risk is probably decreased 2- or 3-fold. This is borne out by other studies which looked at using estrogen in treating women with breast cancer. It's very interesting, Jeff, that the best therapy ever developed to treat metastatic breast cancer was high-dose estrogen. Now, they don't do this anymore because there are some toxic side effects, and some women died from that treatment. However, the majority of the women had total remissions or partial remissions of their metastatic disease. And we believe this is because actually women with breast cancer need the 2-hydroxyestrogen. You know, the modern dogma is take away estrogen from women with breast cancer, give them anti-estrogens. You know, this is also what happens 40 years later, is we find out we've always been doing exactly the wrong thing. Women with breast cancer need estrogen, but they need the right kind of estrogen. This is no different than good cholesterol, bad cholesterol story. We always thought for years that a high cholesterol is bad, right? You have to reduce your cholesterol. We now find you can have a cholesterol of 350 if you have a good HDL level. It doesn't matter. Total cholesterol doesn't matter within the context of knowing the amount of high versus low density. It's exactly the same here. The total amount of estrogen you have is not as important as what you're doing with it. Do you have the good, which is the 2-hydroxy, or do you have the bad, the 16? So it's really important to recognize that this is a new paradigm, which is probably as important as the breakthroughs that followed the recognition that there's different types of cholesterol.
I think that is a very powerful statement, and unfortunately we've come to the end of our time, but I couldn't think of a better summary, Dr. Klug. That, I think, really illustrates the nature of this paradigm shift, this transition that's occurring with endocrinology, moving into what I guess you'd call the functional metabolic consequences and how that influences over a period of time gene expression patterns and metabolic outcome that later we inherited as either healthy aging or unhealthy aging. So a tremendous statement, and obviously this test is now commercially available, so doctors can use urine and serum for analysis of the 2-16 ratio with the antibody test that you've developed. So that's a tremendous contribution you've made. And I presume that people could contact you directly at ImmunoCare if they would care to learn more about the test.
Yes, they can.
We'll make sure that we give that address and your phone number on the summary cards for this month's edition so that they can follow up. And I want to thank you for the extraordinarily precise way that you've described your work and the importance of it. I think it's going to really translate into saving people's premature disease and giving them options that they otherwise did not have.
Well, Jeff, as you and I know, that's really what we're all about. At the bottom line is helping people. So I thank you very much for the opportunity, and maybe sometime in the future we'll have more information and we can go in more detail into the genetics of estrogen metabolism. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thanks a million. Appreciate it, and we'll talk to you soon.
I want to thank Dr. Klug once again for what I'm sure for all of you was a very provocative and informative discussion about these estrogen metabolites and the important role that they may play in our assessment, both in women and men, of a drift or a trajectory of the metabolome of that individual as they head towards either healthy aging or unhealthy aging, and how that interrelates with our just continuing discussion about the hypothalamus-pituitary axis and its influence in gene expression through the secondary modification of these mediators. A couple of thoughts that I wanted to leave you with that are important. Dr. Klug spent quite a bit of time focusing on the hydroxylation patterns of estrogen, the 2 or the 16 hydroxylation patterns, and by association, the 4 hydroxylation patterns that follow the 16 hydroxylation patterns. I want to add one other parenthetical phrase because when he talked about the good estrogen being the 2-hydroxyestrogen, it appears as if the good estrogen, if we can use the term good or bad, which sometimes is probably a problem in itself because anything that's good, it's too good, it gets too much, it can become bad. But let's talk about the 2-hydroxyestrogens for a moment. The really breaking molecule of estrogen-mediated cellular activity is not 2-hydroxylated estrogen, but it's the 2-methoxylated estrogens. You have to first hydroxylate, then you have to methoxylate in order to form the appropriate estrogen break. If we think of the estrogen accelerator as the 16-hydroxyestrogens, then we might think of the estrogen break as the 2-methoxylated estrogens. This is a very important part of the story. By the way, the 4-hydroxylated estrogens also get methoxylated to these non-toxic, in quote, estrogens. 2-methoxyestrone is formed from the 2-hydroxylated compound by way of a methylation reaction that's catalyzed by catechol-O-methyltransferase. Catechol-O-methyltransferase, or COMT, has the role to play in taking a methyl group from SAM, S-adenosylmethionine, and transferring it over to the point where methyl groups are needed. Could be on a DNA molecule, could be on a hydroxylated estrogen, could be on a phospholipid to go from phosphatidylethanolamine to phosphatidylcholine to make myelin of nerves. All we know is that there are very important roles that the SAM conversions in the presence of COMT play. The catechol-methyltransferase enzyme is very polymorphic, many SNPs, that single nucleotide polymorphisms that relate to different activities of COMT. Some people are very sluggish COMT transferers of methyl groups, and so their need for increasing SAM then is unique to their own physiology for promotion of the proper detoxification of their 2-hydroxylated or 4-hydroxylated estrogens. Why am I going into this? Because we shouldn't just stop with indole-3-carbinol as the endpoint for improving estrogen metabolism or soy isoflavones or lignans. We should also talk about those agents that promote methylation. That is part of where the methyl groups come from, which is the tetrahydrofolate cycle. Now I've said folate, you know, that means vitamin B12, folic acid, vitamin B6, betaine or other methyl donor compounds. These become very important part of that cycle, the amino acid serine. All of these work together to create an active available methyl as SAM, S-adenosylmethionine. If there are metabolic disturbances in the folate cycle, like is present in individuals that have methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase polymorphisms, that's MTHFR polymorphisms, then the individual is less able to use their dietary folate in converting it to the active methylating derivative, which is 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate. Boy, this is a lot of biochemical gobbledygook. But it's actually very clinically important, because if that person has a genetic polymorphism in the MTHFR, then they may require either enhanced doses in their diet of folic acid, and the best way of getting that is by giving a folate supplement, not dietary folate, because dietary folates are polyglutamyl folates, which have to be broken down by glutaminase enzymes in the GI mucosa to liberate bioavailable folic acid. The supplemental forms of folic acid are actually, this is one of the few cases, but it's probably true, are more bioavailable than are the food forms of folate. Therefore, folic acid as a supplement may be required for optimal function of that methyl delivery system, or bypassing the block and giving 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, which has now just become commercially available, can also enhance the folic acid metabolism. So the use of 5-methyl-THF to get around that genetic polymorphism, and so you're going to say, but how frequent, Jeff, really, is this genetic polymorphism? Aren't we really just talking about very infrequent expressions? And the answer is no. The evidence would suggest that in the heterozygous form, it can be 20 to 30% of the population that has alterations in their MTHFR, the so-called C-to-T-677 polymorphism. If so, then they may require either enhanced levels of folate in the diet, enhanced B6, B12, and or 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate. That increases SAM, which then helps to drive the sluggish COMT enzyme to methylate the hydroxylated estrogen. So now we get 2-methoxyestrogens, not just stopping along the road. And the 2-methoxyestrogens are the brakes of estrogen metabolism, or the brakes of the mitogenic cell replicative estrogens. So I hope you see that this is a web of interacting variables, a web of different genetic uniquenesses, a web of how we interact with our environment. And yes, we want to increase indole-3-carbinol from crucifers. Yes, we want to increase the soy isoflavones and the lignin components from, say, flax. But yes, we also want to help improve methylation reactions with proper folate, B12, B6, serine, and betaine or other methyl donor compounds. Does things like flax consumption influence estrogen hormone concentrations in postmenopausal women, or are we just really speaking into theoretic space? Well, more and more studies are being published indicating that in clinical trials, in fact, these dietary variables that we've discussed, when augmented in the diet, do influence estrogen levels and estrogen metabolism and the relationship of the metabolites one to the other. Such a paper was published related to flax in its lignin concentration and the influence on endogenous hormone concentrations in postmenopausal women. This appeared in Nutrition and Cancer, Volume 39, page 58 in 2001, in which Joanna Slavin and her colleagues at the University of Minnesota have evaluated then the role that these lignans like introlactone, introdiol have on estrogen in postmenopausal women. I want to emphasize, remember, that these secondary metabolites of lignans occur in the gut by the process of friendly bacteria working on the lignans to increase then the production of compounds like Equol, E-Q-U-O-L. Now, why am I saying that? Because, again, it emphasizes that we live within a system, an ecological system. We don't just live separated from the rest of the environment. Our gut flora, our ecology of our gut, plays a role in how some of these phytonutrients are metabolized and what the end products that are delivered to our neuroendocrine immune systems might be. So if you have friendly gut bacteria, they metabolize lignans in a different way than if you have dysbiotic bacteria, which then creates a different message to the receptor sites of these endocrine modulators, which then produces a different gene expression pattern and a different phenotype. Very powerful examples of this ecologically based functional medicine as contrasted to the medicine of single agents to produce single disease in need of single molecules for their treatment. So I hope you understand this methylation component. Don't just stop solely at the two hydroxylated estrogens. Think also about the methoxylation component. Now let's lastly close this month's functional medicine update with an interesting broad-based study that kind of puts this all together into an interesting and provocative form. And this is a pilot study looking at dietary intervention with stage 3 and stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer patients, most of who would be considered terminal, many with secondary mets to the brain and other tissues, who have gone through traditional therapy and now gotten to the end of their course of success, whose mean average life expectancy from that point on is less than 4 months by statistical evaluation. So this is the end of the line type of study. This is a study done in human subjects, 14 of them, who have elected by informed consent to involved in a nutritional intervention trial, utilizing these complex plant-based materials to modulate different gene expression patterns in their outcome. The patients were from a variety of different places, Mount Sinai Hospital, Kumamoto University Hospital in Japan, Tri-Service General Hospital in Taipei, North Shore University Hospital at Cornell University Medical Center, the Alta Bates Medical Center at Berkeley, University of Washington School of Medicine, and the Fred Hutch Cancer Research Institute, the Palo Alto Medical Clinic, the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, the Massachusetts General Hospital, the Mount Sinai Hospital. I think you get the drift that we're dealing with well-defined cancer in patients whose history is well-known, who have been treated by very high-quality traditional treatments in major cancer treatment centers around the world, who now are at the end of the success of those therapies. And therefore, the approach that they elected to study was that of utilizing a concentrate of a complex mixture of plant foods, all of which had been identified by epidemiological or animal or human observational studies to be associated with lowered incidence of cancer. And these included soybeans, mushrooms, mung beans, red dates, scallions, garlic, lentils, leek, hawthorn fruit, onions, ginger, angelica root, licorice, dandelion root, Senegal root, olive, sesame seeds, parsley. The mushrooms included shiitake mushrooms and maitake mushrooms. So this was a concentrate of this particular series of vegetable products with a wide array of differing phytochemicals that have different effects upon gene expression and proteomic influences. They then used different combinations of these vegetable concentrates and the whole vegetable concentrate, first in animals that had a controlled type of tumor to see if they can influence effects on survival of these tumor-bearing animals, and then after that, asking could they be used safely in humans. The results in animals were quite remarkable, measuring tumor size in tumor-bearing animals. So these are treating cancer with these vegetable concentrates in mice, tumor-bearing mice. These are BALBC mice. The combination of the various vegetable concentrates that I just described produced a synergistic positive effect, more than just additive of the individual effects, which lowered the growth in tumors by a factor of over fourfold versus the control animals. And so there is a very, very powerful reduction in progression seen in these animals who were tumor-bearing animals after administering to them these vegetable concentrate materials in their diet, 10% of their diet, by the way. Well, that's very, very interesting. But in and itself, that doesn't answer the question. What happens when these would be administered to humans who have these fairly serious terminal cancer situations? And the patients were qualified in the study, and there's a wonderful table that defines the characteristics of these patients in the paper. Many of them have metastatic lesions which have been identified by CT scanning, one of which is a patient whose brain tumor is actually followed over a period of about a year after introducing the vegetable concentrates, showing the lesion, the principal site of the brain tumor, completely resolved over about a year plus in giving the vegetable concentrate. And you actually see three different lesions completely resolving through CT scans over that period of time. Another one of the patients is an individual with metastasis to bone that you see the bone lesions resolving over a period, again, of a year and a half on the complex vegetable concentrate supplement. They then talk about the relative survival of these patients versus the projected mean survival that one might expect from traditional response after therapy at the state that they entered the therapy. The mean response, as I said, had them dying on average within 4 months, and many of these patients were still alive at periods over 40 months later. Demonstrable increases in survival of these patients and improved quality of life and reduced new tumor formation. Now, does this answer unequivocally the question as to whether modulation of cell communication occurs in cancer patients by giving vegetable concentrates? Clearly, it doesn't resolve it unequivocally. But it is extraordinarily encouraging, indicating that even at very severe states of dysfunction, which is metastatic disease, that giving differing messages to the genes and differing post-translational effects can produce remarkable differences in cellular outcome, meaning disease is not locked in stone. We do not have deterministically defined cancer, heart disease, or diabetes in most cases. And in fact, by changing the experiment of life at any time, we might be able to turn back some of these expression patterns. This is a very optimistic and uplifting message as we move ourselves into 2002. It gives us a reason for really looking at the science, for a reason for continuing our vigilant studies, a reason for continuing to be warriors and champions of the new medicine. And I can see the dawn of this functional, genomically based medicine emerging to give us tremendous opportunities to be better at what most of us went into this field to do, which is to help people achieve their objectives of 8 or 9 or more decades of high-level living. Thanks for being with us in 2001. We'll look forward to seeing you next year.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine, located in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.